Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we take on a single subject, but we take it on with scholars and people or authorities in the field, and we try to share insights that are not commonly covered by the mainstream or even alternative media. Today, the entire program is devoted to understanding Syria's conflict, its internal conflict, its civil war, and what is the truth of it? We're not here to take sides. We see that there is a conflict in all the countries in the Middle East. Instead, we're here to try to better understand what role the United States military-industrial complex and its various agencies have been playing behind the scenes. Where is this going? What is their motive? In any way, is this realigning the geopolitical map to better suit Israel's needs, to better position the United States so that individuals who are participating in Iran will be more vulnerable? We're not told any of this in the mainstream media. So we're going to talk with a panel on this topic. We have several panelists, including in the latter part of our program, our last guest will be a multi-award-winning journalist, Finian Cunningham. Finian has written extensively on international affairs. He has written in many different languages. He has appeared to give testimony. He was also the master's graduate in agricultural chemistry and worked as a scientific editor for the Royal Society of Chemistry in Cambridge, England. He has been all over the Middle East and East Africa. He is one of those individuals who is not backed off being actually in the war zones. And he was giving commentary until he was expelled from Bahrain for his critical journalism, in which he highlighted many of the human rights violations by the Western-backed regime. For many years, he worked as an editor and writer in mainstream media, including The Mirror, The Irish Times, and The Independent. Originally from Belfast, Ireland, he's now based in East Africa, and we'll be speaking with him by Skype from East Africa. In the United States, we'll be speaking with Russ Baker. Russ Baker is an award-winning investigative reporter and journalist, and he is the founder of the independent progressive news and analysis site whowhatwhy.com. And over the past two decades, he has produced over 1,000 stories on a broad range of topics, from political revolutions to revolutionary humor. He's covered the Hutu Tutsi massacres in Central Africa and Rwanda, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the overthrow of the remaining dictator. And he received the Society for Professional Journalists Award, the Meccan and Common Cause Awards, and he served as the adjunct faculty member at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And his research into the rise and election of George W. Bush led to his bestseller, Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. His website is whowhatwhy.com. And providing that we can reach him, we will have also on a multi-award-winning author and scholar, a sociologist and geopolitical analyst specializing on the Middle East and Central Asia, who's also a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal and a contributor at the Strategic Cultural Foundation in Moscow and the Voltaire Net. He's a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica in Italy. And he is Mahdi Darius Nazim Rahosh. And he will be available, hopefully, a little later on in the program if we're able to connect with him. But let's begin with Russ Baker. Nice to have you with us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you, Gary.
I've read many of your articles on this topic, and as we always do with this program, I open up the commentary with an overview, an arching overview, and then stay quiet and invite my guests to share more of a classroom on the air, because this is the one program on radio, and by the way, the most downloaded program in all of radio that we're aware of, commercial and non-commercial. Tens of thousands of people will download this in the evening alone, and that's because it's an in-depth discussion, so you will not be interrupted until you feel you've made your point, and we'll go to another issue. So here's our beginning point. I want to take a look at the lies and deceptions of our getting into Iraq to bring peace, democracy, and freedom, and to Afghanistan to take care of the people who were responsible for 9/11, and then bring peace, freedom, and democracy to that country, and to Libya to bring peace, freedom, and democracy. And always the American media, both left and right, except for the more progressive media, aligns itself with the government. Then there is the demonization process. That will take anywhere from a few weeks to several months, where we paint our enemy as being so horrific that they are literally like Hitlers, and they've even been called little Hitlers. And we never touch upon our previous relationships with any of these people, whether it was Noriega in Panama or Saddam Hussein in Iraq. We simply start at this moment demonizing him. Then we intervene, we have regime change, and multinationals come in, and the amount of corruption is phenomenal. The amount of cash alone in Iraq is estimated at over $20 billion missing that no one can account for. According to Nobel Prize winning economist from Columbia University, Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, who we interviewed, it is estimated that this war in Iraq alone, all told, will cost about $3 trillion. In Afghanistan, all told, about $3 trillion. We then have supporters in the area, in the Arab League nations and non-Arab League nations. Without exception, we have supported those who are the dictators and the despotic governments that rule their people ruthlessly. That is true the Shah of Iran, when we were responsible, along with British intelligence, for overthrowing the duly elected head of Iran at the time and installing the Shah of Iran. We never said a word for 25 years when he was brutalizing his own people. We support the Saud family in Saudi Arabia. And even with the $60 billion weapons that they gave us just this year alone, contract, and we're the largest exporter of weapons in the world, we never challenge them publicly, and I'm sure not even privately, on their gross repression of the Shia in their own country and their propagation of human rights abuses. When you look at all the Arab Spring uprisings, we were behind the regime in every single case. Only in the last hour in Egypt, only when Mubarak was losing power and we saw a shift coming, did we align ourselves supposedly with the pro-democracy movement. Only then to back off when we realized that the younger people were going to be supporting a change, but the change would not influence those in power. So we realigned quietly with the military. Now that people who fought in the square are angry because the Muslim Brotherhood's in power, the military's in power, and they're still where they were. And so many people are confused. They're confused because we don't know what our real position is. We clearly know that we're not there to support peace, democracy, and freedom. In Libya, we caused over 300 different tribes to be in conflict with one another, and Libya today is massively disorganized. In Syria, we've been told that the human rights abuses are exclusively on the side of the ruling party, and that the people who are fighting the Saud regime are freedom fighters, and we should support them. Now, that's the official story from the Middle East, and the average American is clueless. They don't know that Saudi Arabia, back Bahrain, when Bahrain was having its pro-democracy movement, Saudi Arabia troops came in, Bahrainian government officials fired on and killed and imprisoned the students and younger people. America said nothing. We know that in Libya, we did not need to invade Libya. The UN did not. But we did, and we were the ones who paid for it, and we were the ones who provide the intelligence and boots on the ground. Now we're told we have boots on the ground, and we're supporting it. That's our concern. I'm going to keep quiet now. I've given you a large map to work with, and take us piece by piece through understanding the truth of what's going in Syria, what it means for us, what is the likely outcome, and where are we going to go if this leads to, ultimately, war with Iran, and what role that our conquest, our about to be conquested of Syria, will play in that. The forum is yours.
Thanks, Gary. First of all, I want to say that I think transparency is very, very important, and people need to know who is speaking and what they're talking about. So just to repeat my name, Russ Baker. I am a longtime investigative journalist. I am the founder of a website, whowhatwhy.com. It is a nonprofit. You mentioned the word progressive, but we actually do not append that. We are very careful to say that we are only interested in establishing what can be established of facts, and we leave it to others to characterize or to editorialize. And I think that's a very, very important role to play. One of the things I discovered throughout my career, and I wrote for and worked in both in print and in television and radio, a broad range of outlets, everything from places like The Village Voice and The Nation magazine, traditional liberal left publications, to mainstream outlets like The New York Times and CBS and so forth, and then even doing a little bit of work at one point with Fox. So I've been able to and been exposed to all of these different types of things, and I find something missing in all of them. And that is what I was trained to do at the Columbia School of Journalism was, you're supposed to go into a story without an agenda. You're supposed to go in without any kind of preconceptions, without any fears of reporting anything that you discover. And so that's the mission of Who, What, Why. And the reason I started it, you mentioned my book, Family of Secrets. I was interested in knowing why the Bush family became so powerful and did what they did. And when I began looking into that, I found that people just dismissed it. They said, well, we're moving on. We're sick of that subject and we don't want to know. And I found that very, very troubling. In the 5 years that I spent investigating the Bush family for Family of Secrets, one of the things I looked at was what you mentioned, Iraq, and what the backstory was there. And I have to say that among the many, many revelations that I came upon, basically just by being curious and having an open mind, was that George W. Bush himself had confided in someone he was very close with an intention to invade Iraq several years before 9/11. And so the various reasons they gave that this was in response to 9/11, then later weapons of mass destruction, and then later that it was for purposes of advancing democracy, all of those were untrue. George W. Bush's motives were very, very simple. Number one, some of the people backing him were looking for an opportunity to take out regimes they saw as uncooperative. That was one thing. But in terms of him personally, he had become convinced by Karl Rove and some of his other advisors that it was very, very difficult to attain a large majority of the American people in terms of getting support for a mandate unless you had a war. And unless you won that war. And he had been convinced that this was going to be a cakewalk, and I'm afraid, and I'm sorry to say that such a simplistic notion had a great deal of influence on him personally in deciding to go ahead with that war. So that's Iraq. That's the first thing. Now, as far as Libya goes, by the time Libya rolled around, Who, What, Why was up and running, and when that first, when the uprising first began, I think our reaction was, well, great, you know, democratic uprising, terrific, perhaps like Egypt. But the more we looked at it and we saw, as you pointed out, the enthusiastic American support for the rebels, we said, well, this does not fit the pattern, the reticence that you discussed when the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton were so cautious and reticent to get behind the students in Tahrir Square. And so we wanted to know, what is the motivation of the United States to take such a pro-democracy, such a pro-revolt stance in Libya? And as we looked at it, we noticed a number of things. And if there's time, I'd like to go through them, because these are going to be applicable then to Syria.
Well, we do have the time. That's why I said, please take your time. There is no rushing. And by the way, we were just informed that Ahmadi is on the line as well, so we'll go to him a little later, but I just want to acknowledge him. Mahdi, welcome to the program. We look forward to having an in-depth discussion with you following Russ Baker. All right. So please take your time, Russ, and give us the backstory.
Sure.
Because you cannot disconnect our involvement in Afghanistan, in Iraq, without also mentioning Libya, and from Libya, Syria.
Okay. So as far as Libya goes, and I would just like to mention that anyone listening who wants to get more detail on this, and of course we can't do all of it on the program, but on our website, whowhatwhy.com, there's a search box, and if you just type in the word Libya, you can bring up all kinds of stories that go into great detail. In any case, the first thing that we noticed about Libya was that a former cabinet minister was put forward to say that he had defected, and he was announcing that he possessed personal proof that that Muammar Gaddafi had himself ordered the bombing of Pan Am 103, the so-called Lockerbie bombing. Now, that caught my attention because the Libyan government has always denied, even though they did agree to pay something to settle a kind of a worldwide boycott, they have always denied complicity in that bombing, and certainly there has never been any evidence that Gaddafi himself ordered that bombing. And so I was struck...
Yeah. I just want to interrupt, and I won't do this again, but... There is not just no proof that Libya engaged in this, there is a major investigative report that is finished and was published as a document on Al Jazeera, where a team of investigators, independent Scottish and English investigators, went through all the evidence and found that none of the evidence was actually accurate. And you see step by step all their footprints, and had they had a little more time, the person who was in the Scottish hospital and prison system would have been exonerated, and their own jurists have acknowledged that. This is a backstory that no one in America, nowhere in the rest of the world, has been made aware of, except unless you watched, as I did, the full documentary on deconstructing the myth that Libya was responsible for the bombing. They went through all the shirt that the man supposedly wore that was the proof, and found out that there was no shirt sold in that store, that the original information on the receipt showed no shirt at all. And then the man says, no, I don't sell shirts. I never sold this man a shirt. I don't remember this man. Then later, after being coached by the police, came back and added in handwriting, off on a type, wrote in a shirt, but then got the wrong color of the shirt. So, I mean, that's just one tiny piece of the information, and there's many, many more that will show you compellingly. But none of this information will ever appear in the United States in any of the media because it would show that we were wrong. Please continue, and I won't interrupt you again.
Sure. Well, those are all very valid points. And I think the larger issue here is that we in the United States think we are well informed, and we are not. We are shockingly misinformed about the most elementary things, and that's really why I started Who, What, Why, because I could see that I was having difficulty, even in your favorite so-called progressive magazine, getting these kinds of stories in there. They were really just not interested. And so, anyway, when we heard that this allegation by this former cabinet minister of Libya that he was going to produce the evidence linking Gaddafi, first of all, that story went all over the world. That was a headline everywhere. Your favorite, liberal British paper or American left cable channel. All of these places picked up that story. What they didn't pick up was that he never produced the evidence. He said he was going to be giving it to journalists. It's now, 2 years later. That evidence has never been produced, and nobody did the story of the propaganda, the story that he told, that story that it went everywhere, that it influenced people and it further vilified Gaddafi and bolstered the support for an invasion there. And in fact, that he never produced the evidence. So that was the first thing that struck us. The second thing was, you may remember that a woman entered the hotel in Tripoli where all the reporters were sitting around just waiting for a story, and she began yelling that she had been raped. She said she was a lawyer from Benghazi, the rebel-held portion of the country, that she had made her way to Tripoli, and that she had been raped by militias loyal to and presumably acting under the orders of Gaddafi. This story was picked up all over the United States, and it went all over the world. What struck us at the time was how unusual it is for any rape victim anywhere in the world to go public with their name and their picture, and of course how astonishing it is that a woman in a Muslim society where women are treated as the culprit in their own rapes would choose to go public. And then it occurred to us how unusual it was that that she would make that journey, and also that she would know who had raped her, and that even if it was a militia, that she could possibly claim that that had anything to do with Gaddafi himself. And so none of it made any sense. And we looked into that. We raised questions about it. We got a lot of flack from people who said, how can you question any rape victim? And we realized how effective that was as a propaganda tool. The Lockerbie bombing story influenced disproportionately men to turn against Gaddafi, and the rape story disproportionately women. That story was never verified. Then later, Gary, they began saying that Gaddafi himself had ordered mass rapes, and you may remember that story, which again went all over the world. And here we were told that purported human rights groups had evidence of this, but on whowhatwhy.com we went and we looked into that, and in fact there were no human rights groups. They were phony front groups. One of them was run by an investment banker who lived in London and who had tried to do business with Gaddafi and been unsuccessful. We also then looked at just the logic of this. Why would a man like Gaddafi, who's on the ropes, fearing for his future and his life, win a PR battle by committing mass rape? It just didn't make any sense. And of course, none of that turned out to be true. And here it is a couple of years later. Nobody's ever come up with the evidence. In fact, the only thing we know about mass rape is the mass rapes that were committed by the other side. A story that is not being covered. So Libya, we could see that there was an orchestrated psyops or psychological operation, very, very sophisticated. The combined might of American intelligence, British intelligence, the Saudis, Bahrain, Qatar, all of these things. Qatar, of course, with Al Jazeera, run by the emir there. Al Jazeera, a station a lot of people think tells the truth, again covering for these phony stories. And so basically what we saw in Libya, what we saw was an organized coup effort. It was begun in concert with French intelligence. It was an opportunity to take the crude oil producing fields, but more importantly it was an opportunity as part of this overall plan that has been in place for many, many years, and Wesley Clark has talked about this, to remove all regimes that are not fully compliant with Western desires in terms of the Middle East. And so you saw that with Saddam Hussein, you saw that with Gaddafi, and now you see that with Syria. Now another important issue there, Gary, is that Gaddafi has always been seen as fiercely independent. In fact, he was a key advocate of Pan-Arabism, that he Pan-Africanism. He was encouraging African countries sitting on tremendous amounts of natural resources to get together and create their own version of OPEC. And of course, you could imagine how threatening this was to Western oil and mining and other resource extraction companies. He also had talked about creating their own currency and to not let the dollar be the dominant currency. All of these things put him in the crosshairs of various Western interests. And then also on whowhatwhy.com, we tell about what happened when Goldman Sachs went in there and began trying to manipulate him and fool him and to basically raid the sovereign wealth fund of Libya. So it's an incredible story that has never been told to the American people. Really, really an incredible story. As you pointed out, I think your analysis is correct. It was simply a raw power grab. Now we turn to Syria. And I'm afraid that Syria it's different, but it's ultimately similar. My read on Syria, and I see the exact same pattern, they're bribing people there to defect. We see this today with the prime minister defecting. These people read the writing on the wall. It's not that they're defecting because they necessarily support the opposition, but they can see that the combined combined might of all of these countries is so great that there's simply no way that Assad can survive in the long run. So they're defecting. In many of these situations, they are promised that millions of dollars have been placed in a Swiss bank account for them and so forth. But what we're seeing with Syria is this. Syria is the one country where there is not an appreciable amount of oil. And so people say, well, there can't be that can't be the motive. And it seems to me, and again, this is only an educated guess, but it makes sense that with the United States having withdrawn from Iraq, with the tremendous amount of oil still to be pulled out of the ground there and all of these Western oil companies drilling, what they need is they need security forces very close to Iraq. And, of course, what's right next door to Iraq is Syria. It's a perfect place to put Western bases because people cannot say, hey, you're in there because of the oil, and there is, in fact, no oil. So I think that's one of a number of factors. Obviously, Israel fits into the equation. But I think more important than that is that Syria is one of Iran's last allies, and I think this is part of a series of dominoes they need before taking out Iran itself. I'm afraid that the situation with Iran is the same, as it has nothing to do with Iran being a threat to anyone. Iran, whatever you want to say about it, the people who run that country are very rational in their own right, and they know perfectly well if they ever attacked Israel or anywhere else that they would be finished, and the only likelihood of them doing so will be when they themselves are under attack. Situation with all those countries, by the way, you again, Gary, obviously very well versed in these things. You pointed out the issue of Shia versus Sunni. We see this in Syria. We see that with Iran. And we see, and we've written on whowhatwhy.com about what we call the Arab Spring no one will cover, and that's the one in Saudi Arabia. The eastern province, the part of Saudi Arabia where the vast majority of the oil fields are, has a large and a significant minority of Shiites who have relatives living in places like Iran and Syria. And those people feel oppressed, and they've been demonstrating, and the Saudis have put those demonstrations down repressively. The United States has never said a word. United States media has never covered that. And I think that there's a sense that Assad, I mean, it can be overthrown, and then it's a Sunni majority there. So I think that's a lot of what you see going on. I think all of these factors come into play. I think that different advocates of military action there have their own motives. And I think there are well-meaning people who support the uprising there. I mean, I certainly am completely in favor of the Syrian people having self-determination. I realize that the Assad regime is brutal and repressive, but I think it's important for us as journalists to distinguish the fact that brutal, repressive regimes have always been or the norm in that region, and the United States, Britain, France, and so forth have never had any problem per se with that, have never opposed that, and often have introduced that there. So, you know, I have more things to say, but I don't want to do too much of a single soundbite here. I just wanted to kind of give that background and explain that this is why we started WhoWhatWhy.com. We're an entity that takes no advertising and no money from corporations. We're entirely dependent on public support so that we can look at these things in this kind of objective way and bring you the sorts of stories that you don't get even from your favorite other nonprofit, supposedly progressive left shows that are not talking about this. And I think the reason, by the way, they're not talking about it, there's one particular television show I'm sure many of you watch, and they don't talk about this. I saw they had a couple of guests talking about Syria, and they were disagreeing only about the extent to which the West ought to be supporting the uprising in Syria. They didn't have any of this analysis. And I think the reason is because after Vietnam, lessons were learned very slowly that you couldn't afford to have a large and principled opposition in the United States, and you needed to co-opt that opposition. And they realized the way to do it was to be behind the scenes, pulling the strings rather than overtly involved in military action. And they did it beautifully in Libya, and they're doing it even better in Syria. What the story is that this is just a domestic uprising, and a brutal regime is committing mass rape, and we heard about stories that are not confirmed. And again, you can read about that in our articles on who, what, why.
Russ, let me intervene here for a moment.
Sure.
I'm disappointed in some of the people who call themselves progressive but are really ideologically left. And they have never once promoted the third-party candidates. Recently, just last week, I was listening to one in the morning, and they had on a person that was formerly a climate change denier, and then now has written a book, Why Climate Change is Real and We're the Cause of It. But on the subject of what we should do, the person stated very clearly that gas hydrofracking and natural gas was the solution, that China and nowhere else in the world will they be able to, for the next 30 years, get off oil, coal, and gas, therefore shift over from coal. So the culprit was coal, and gas is the solution. And when there was a question about their association with the Koch brothers and the foundation, there was a strong defense of the Koch brothers and the foundation, and not once was there any scholarship to challenge on gas hydrofracking. And we have led multiple demonstrations, including in front of the governor's office, on gas hydrofracking. We have scientific articles up showing the lack of scientific validity behind gas hydrofracking. And Germany now has over 53% of its total energy from solar, so it's not true that we would have to wait 30 years before we could use alternative therapies and alternative energy sources. Iceland uses geothermic in a major way, and other countries have other therapies, other energy sources they could use. I was just appalled by the lack of scholarship and objectivity and allowing someone to use that forum, which is listened to over the different Pacifica stations and on cable stations, without any challenge. Then on the subject of Syria, they have been doing nothing promoting one side of the issue. And I don't believe that until you have people on the ground who are independent, free of any ideology, and are examining the facts, that you should be aligning yourself, because you then become an extension of the military-industrial complex's agenda, like it or not. And that's what's happened on one of the more popular stations. Popular as far as name, people only saw the ratings, they'd be somewhat surprised how small an audience, but nonetheless, a vehicle on the left. So I agree with that. Now I'm going to read, before we go to our next guest, I'm going to read a little bit of your article from Global Research, called Everything They're Telling Us About Syria is False. And this is from Russ Baker.
Okay, by the way, just so you know, that's a who, what, why article. We just allow other websites like that to reprint them.
Okay, but that's actually to your favor, because Global Research is really an outstanding source for a lot of quality information you want
to
get.
Well, sure, and we're delighted, by the way, to have them and many, many other sites regularly pick up our stuff. Very,
right.
Very happy to have
so
that relationship.
Let me read what you wrote here that no one else did. I'll quote this. We read it in the New York Times and elsewhere about one of Syrian President Bashar Assad's most important supporters and allies having defected. The impression one gets is that Assad's government is in a state of collapse, and this gives credibility to those pushing for Assad to turn over power. But what the media are not mentioning is that Brigadier General Manaf Tlass did not defect directly from the Assad inner circle. He had already fallen in disfavor early in the uprising and lost his command 14 months ago. If you had that additional piece of information, you would interpret the news reports in a totally different way. When a piece of evidence that contradicts the overall impression is absent from the reportage itself is almost worthless, as are reports of horrific events without adequate fact-checking and follow-up. Remember the massacre in Halle? Who carried that out? The media told us that more than 100 people, including women and children, were brutally slaughtered at close range in the village of Halle in late May. The bloodshed reported around the world was ascribed to a militia which is loyal to Assad. And then it goes on, you talk about what the BBC said, and then you talk about what a German reporter for a major German newspaper who was in the community had to say, Rainer Herrmann, and says that these eyewitnesses were Assad opponents, not Assad supporters, yet discovered that government backers were not responsible for the massacre. Now, Herman's sources describe the events as follow. Anti-Assad rebels attacked army road checks just outside of Halle, which had been intended to protect villages, where the majority are members of Assad's Alawi sect for Sunni militias. The soldiers at the roadblocks, overwhelmed, call for backup, which led to a 90-minute battle in which both sides sustained extensive casualties. It was in this time frame that the unidentified militias entered the town. As Herman wrote on June 7th, quote, according to eyewitness accounts, those killed were almost exclusively from families belonging to the Alawi and Shia minorities. Over 90% of the town's population are Sunnis. Several dozen members of a family were slaughtered, which had converted from Sunni to Shia Islam. Members of one family, an Alawi family, were also killed, as was the family of a Sunni member of the Syrian parliament who is regarded as a collaborator. Immediately following the massacre, the perpetrators are supposed to have filmed their victims and then presented them as Sunni victims in videos posted on the internet. But they were not. They were Shia victims. Their findings contradict allegations of the rebels who have blamed the militias, which are close to the regime, end quote. Hence, Herman seemingly was able to do something that most of the Western reporters have been unable to do, find opponents of Assad who nevertheless may be willing to provide accounts that do not serve their own interest. Now, what is important for me is when I read this article of yours, is that any truly objective person, and certainly an objective and independent thinking journalist, would have realized that in these conflicts, before you ascribe blame to one or the other side, you have to have accurate reportage. Otherwise, we fall right back to the first Gulf conflict, where we were told that not only did Saddam Hussein's forces go into Kuwait, but they went into a paternity ward and threw babies on the floor and stole their incubators. We were told this with great emotional outpouring, and only later did we find out that that was not true at all, and the woman who was making the statements was actually the daughter of the ambassador there, and also was a part of the largest PR firm, I think it was Hill Knowlton, and therefore it was a pure piece of propaganda. It was all made up. And yet the American media did not criticize it, didn't question it, didn't verify it. But that was enough to provoke then the final tipping point. So I'm thinking, if we knew the truth, the real truth, would we still be in the same position? Which, in my opinion, is that we're just one heartbeat away from NATO or some other source and force going in and removing, as we did in Libya, the Syrian regime, and then bringing in people who we're told are the freedom fighters. Remember the so-called liberation forces of of the Iraq Iraq National Governing Oversight Committee, and that man ended up being an embezzler. In fact, he was tried in absentia in Jordan for the embezzlement over $100 million, and he. He was the man that was the front person for Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in Iraq. He was a criminal, and is a criminal, because he's never been held accountable to sent back to Jordan to serve his prison sentence, and yet we all believed everything he said, just like we believe curveball. All curveball, there's weapons of mass destruction. There was not. And Judith Miller got that source from Scooter Libby out of Vice President Cheney's office. They had their own intelligence division. The real CIA had already found that curveball, the primary source that led us into the Iraq conflict, was false, as had German intelligence. Now, so Cheney gets his own intelligence groups together, and they have supersede in power and authority because of Cheney's ruthlessness, that they give that to Judith Miller, and Miller went and to the New York, with the New York Times pieces that convinced a lot of people on the left that this was a right war, even though we're supposedly against war. This was the right war, like Barack Obama. Afghanistan's the right war. Nonsense. So all of this fits together, and now I'm seeing we're being played with the same storybook. We don't know what is real, but what we do know is we cannot rely upon the agencies. We cannot rely upon the United States government. We know that we've been had. What we don't know is what is the real motive? Is it to align ourselves better with Israel so Israel doesn't have a problem going after Iran and using Syria, knowing Syria will not be a staging base for Iran to come back into Israel? We don't know that yet. So we're dealing in the dark. Your final thoughts before we go to our guests on any of the statements I just made, please.
Sure. I mean, I guess my main focus and my main concern is just how bad the media is. And this, the kind of thing you were referring to, these sorts of handouts from insiders, leak journalism, which dominates and has always dominated journalism, is not real journalism. And things are getting so bad in the world on so many fronts. If we don't fix journalism, we are sunk. And I think that the fact that the same tricks can be played on the American people again and again tell you how bad it is and that we need to reinvent the entire paradigm. So I'll just leave it to say that that's our mission at whowhatwhy.com, and we certainly welcome the help and the support of the American public and the international public in trying to do something entirely new.
Russell Baker, thank you. Please hold on, because at the near after my other guests have had a chance to speak, and I do not limit this show. However long it goes, that's how long it goes. But I want some final thoughts from you. Let's now go over and say hello again to Mahdi Darius. Thank you again for being with us and your patience and holding on here.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Let me again give some of your background. And you are an award-winning author and scholar, a sociologist, and a geopolitical analyst specializing on the Middle East and Central Asia. You're a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. You're a contributor at the Strategic Cultural Foundation in Moscow and the Voltaire Net. And you're a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica in Italy. And during the Arab Spring, Mahdi reported from North Africa, particularly in Libya, during the NATO bombing, providing dispatches to Global Research and also Flashpoint at Pacifica. And your work frequently appears in Al Jazeera and Russian TV. You're the author of Globalization of NATO and a forthcoming book, The War on Libya and the Recolonization of Africa. The website is globalresearch.com and voltairenet.org. Now, would you... Since you've been listening to most of what we've discussed, I would like you to take us through your journey of showing we're connecting Libya only in so much as we have the same cast of characters who are telling us it's for freedom and democracy and peace that we went into Libya, and look what happened to Libya. And could you give us an update on Libya today and on who's in power? And what this actually achieved, who benefited from this, and then take us from there into Syria, and what you see as the untold story in Syria. What do you believe, from your own analysis, are the real objectives that we will be engaged, because Syria represents no threat to us or to any other country that I'm aware of, except for Israel. But and what do you see Israel's position being behind all this? The forum is yours. Take your time. There is no rushing. As much time as needed, that's how much time you have.
Well, let me begin by saying that the Libya of today, 2012, is a broken state. It does not have a central government in operation. The transitional council that's taken over in Tripoli is basically the equivalent of what Hamid Karzai was in Afghanistan. They called him the mayor of Kabul. They have no power outside of Tripoli or the streets. In the south, there's different groups running Fezzan. In Benghazi, well, we know that they want to break up. In Misurata, the military council of Misurata is running the show. And in Tripoli, there are I think the best word for them is warlords in the streets. Torture is rampant. If people were complaining about Gaddafi, it seems like those were the good days. Torture now, racial targetings, black-skinned Libyans and African workers from parts of Africa where they're black-skinned have been targeted. Foreign workers from Eastern Europe have been targeted. The country is broken, and I was in Mexico, actually, speaking to a colleague there from one of their universities, and we were discussing Libya, and he made a very valid point that I want to bring into the picture here. In Mexico, many thousands of people die every year, And people won't know from going to Acapulco or Cancun what's happening there. There's a crime war in Mexico, and the nation is actually it's pretty unstable in the countryside. But Mexico is very stable when it comes to its foreign exports, when it comes to foreign relations. But internally, the country has this latent war going on. And that's exactly what the United States wants in Libya. That's exactly what it wants in Iraq. Look at Iraq. There's still fighting in Iraq. It's still unstable inside. They're at each other in sectarian and ethnic terms, but it's still exporting its oil. So this is what the United States wants. It wants countries that are internally unstable, but they can always meet their foreign obligations of sending resources out and being there at UN meetings or any other international forums that there are. So that's how I analyze the situation in Libya and speaking to people there. Children, when I mean children, I mean people of 17, 16 years of age being tortured. You know, I've got God knows how many people I've got asking me for help to get out of the country because of torture, and it's really bad there.
All right. Also, we're aware that what was the ideal irrigation system costing billions of dollars has been taken over. We also know that the oil has been appropriated by different regions, and now there are clans claiming that the resources in that area belong to them, are not willing to share or cooperate with a central government, and we have lots of foreign mercenaries who have appeared in the country, were there, and were brought in. And all the while, the United States' military behind the scenes was orchestrating a lot of the effort at the sabotage, and all in the name of bringing freedom. Your thoughts about why is it the American media hasn't caught on to this? These are not stupid people who work for the New York Times or Washington Post or Los Angeles Times or CNN. They're very intelligent. And if you could find this out, if Russ Baker could find it out, if Finian Cunningham, our last guest today, can find it out, why can't they find it out? They certainly have more resources than you all.
Well, I have to tell you that the media in the United States is an extension of the Pentagon and the intelligence services. This is what I know from my own experiences of dealing with the media, and I've a lot of these people reporting from the war zone. I knew, I met on a personal level. We had our differences. I can tell you that a lot of them were caught spying. A lot of them were caught sending out information. Their equipment was not journalistic. It was there for getting IP numbers, for sending out information. There was British journalists who were sending locations to be bombed in Libya. That includes American journalists who were sending locations to be bombed in Libya. They were using different ways of doing this. For example, they would send out emails where the period in the email would actually be a picture that was shrunk to the size of a period. You know, this is the sort of behavior. They were caught in my hotel looking at the electronic equipment in the basement, which was not an area that journalists were allowed to go to, and trying to put something there. I don't know where to begin. We brought Russ Baker brought up the woman who was accused of being raped. Well, I can tell you that being in that hotel and hearing some of their comments joking about her before being there after this happened, of course, but hearing some of the journalists' jokes about her, it seemed to me like they knew exactly what happened, and it was very funny for them, actually. So the media, I'm not saying everybody. This is actually a danger to real journalism, is the fact that you have intelligence operatives and agents that have been planted into the media and that are involved in this type of work of giving locations to bomb. And they're not, and in fact, they use the media. Like you could see in Syria, the media is not there to report on what's happening. It's not even there just image for perception management. It actually helps shape the events. You know, in Tripoli, when I was there during the siege, the media, I could tell you I was there for months, and they were lying about places that had fallen to the insurgents. They were making up these locations because everybody in the media corps was being taken to these locations. So, but they were still reporting about these places. And they were like, for example, Le Monde in France took a picture of an empty part of the beach and said Tripoli's a ghost town. And it wasn't. This was part of the perception management. But it was also helping shape events when they're saying this person defected, this fell. It was putting pressure on the Libyans internally, specifically the regime. So when I read the media reports here, I can see sometimes it's very targeted. It's not targeted for the average person. Sometimes it's targeted for people within the opposing government to read, to put pressure on them. You know, like the assassination that happened in Damascus on the 18th of July. Well, this was, I'm sorry, the 18th of June. Well, this was like, it was part of this PSYOP against the country. You know, they were trying to destroy the command structure in the country, while the media, all of a sudden, the fuel on the fire was increased, and they were projecting these reports of the regime about to fall. They did this in Tripoli while I was in Libya, and Tripoli while I was there. And something that just comes out of mind. I don't want to talk in tangents, but for example, one British reporter, after they bombed farmers, innocent farmers, wrote that all the farmers were men of military age. You know, he was talking about a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, people that past 60. Well, anybody could be of military age, but he specifically used that word to put doubt in readers' minds. Like, when you say men of military age, you're appropriating their civilian identity, and you're saying that this person could be a soldier. Anybody could be of military age, basically. And this is the type of words they use. They wouldn't call the national military the national military. They would use words like the Gaddafi brigades or Gaddafi's militias. And they do this in Syria, Assad's brigades. They use sectarian language. In fact, every nuance and shred of reporting about Syria has such bias, even from the progressive side. They don't realize that they're actually replicating Orientalist discourse when they speak. They start talking about Shiitism, Sunni. They say Shiite Iran is an ally of Sunni of Syria's Alawite regime. Well, if you look at the composure of the regime, it's actually mostly not Alawites. The Alawites have a higher representation within the military, which is the core, the backbone of the government. But this is the type of language they use, and they keep on saying Shiite Iran is allied with the Shiite. It's like saying the predominantly Protestant United States is allied with Sunni Saudi Arabia. Like, we don't use this type of language when we speak about the Protestant United States is allied with Roman Catholic Italy, you know, or they start saying Shiite Crescent Iran is spreading its Shiite influence and the Shiites are working together. Does anybody say that the Italians want to create a Roman Catholic Empire and the Roman Catholic Croats and Roman Catholic Spaniards have this commonality with them? No, but when it comes to the Middle East, this type of discourse is acceptable. And you'll always find them saying Shiite Iran, the Alawites. It's actually not like that on the ground. And they're trying to create this mirage that they're killing each other. It's partial. There is now a truth to it because they've been so successful in creating fighting in the region. But they're creating this mirage where and they want this. This is wishful thinking on their part, where there is this Shiite and Sunni schism. They want that region torn up. They want the different peoples there, which includes Christians. There's Orthodox Christians and Roman Catholic, Eastern Catholics there. And they want that region torn up between them all. When in reality, I could tell you in Libya, the people who were going around in these death squads had NATO attachments with them. When I was in Tripoli, there was people from NATO on the ground, you know. And when I said this, people outside in North America were you know, they were questioning it. But then later they all admitted that yes, we did have these things on there. We did have these forces on the ground. You know, the blood in Libya and in Syria, it's on the hands of the United States government. Hillary Clinton, President Obama, all have blood on their hands. You know, when Kofi Annan resigned, and then they say that they say that, oh, well, we had CIA already there. They were just releasing. Everybody knew. Everybody was aware that they were already there. But they say this. Well, what does that mean? Did you really want peace while you were supporting one side? No, that means that you were not impartial at all, and you didn't want peace because you were supporting the insurgent side the whole time. So you were actually sabotaging the whole peace plan.
Let us take it a little step further. What role do you believe Israel and the Mossad are playing in destabilizing Syria in order to, or exacerbate the situation in Syria to further its own ends at regime change and positioning towards Iran?
Well, Syria wanted, Tel Aviv wanted regime change from the very beginning. Some of the media here tries to hide that fact, saying, oh, well, they don't want them, they're afraid of instability reaching them, and no. They've actually wanted it. If you listen to a lot of their military spokesmen and reports, they wanted it. In fact, they're the authors of a document called The Clean Break. It's from Israel, written in 1996. Richard Perle is one of the authors of that document, as well as Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor was one of the authors. It's called The Clean Break, and the term rolling back Syria, which a lot of authors now quote, comes from that document. They say that we need it. This is what they say. We need to break up Iraq, essentially, into a Shiite Sunni area. We use the Sunnis in Iraq. We use Jordan. We use Turkey to go after Syria. That's exactly what I'm paraphrasing. They also say we need to distract Syria through anti-Syrian Lebanese opposition forces, and that's the March 14th Alliance led by Saeed Hariri, which is the son of slain Lebanese premier or prime minister Rafik al-Hariri. So the Israelis are very much attached. The Washington Post said the Mossad is even acting on the border very quietly. You know, Israeli weapons have been found in Syria. This is something that the Israelis want because the Israelis are afraid of when they do get into a war with Iran, and the United States is as well, that Syria will be an Iranian ally and involved in the combat, as well as the Lebanese. So they want to nullify neutralize the Syrians before they can turn their directions to Iran. Now, I'm very skeptical about the Israelis being able to attack Iran themselves. They don't have the capabilities to attack Iran. Yes, they have nuclear weapons, but they do not have the capabilities to take out all of Iran's nuclear sites, nor do they have the capabilities to go into a full-out war with the Iranians. There's a lot of psychological. The Israelis are they use a lot of psychological illusions to make themselves stronger than they are. They've only been fighting against Lebanese resistant movement, which isn't even a full military. Palestinian civilians who have rockets or very primitive rockets. You know, those rockets are very primitive. So they're not the military powerhouse that they're made out to be. I don't think they're in Iran's league in a conventional war whatsoever. The other reason that I think that the Syrians are being targeted is because of what's happening in Iraq. Iraq is falling into Iran's orbit. If it fully falls into the Iranian orbit, that makes Iranian influence reach the Mediterranean coast straight from the Iranian border. So Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon. This means troop movements, any type of movement. This actually upsets the geostrategic balance in the region. So while Iraq is going into the Iranian orbit, the United States wants to take Syria out of the Iranian orbit. And of course, if you do that, you detach Iran from its Levantine allies, the Palestinian resistance movements such as Hamas, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, various other groups. You'd be detaching Iran from them, and as well as the resistance movements in Lebanon, particularly Hezbollah, the most powerful political and social movement in Lebanon. So you'd be disconnecting them. And Syria's the linchpin of what is called I call the resistance bloc, others call the axis of resistance, which includes Iran, essentially members, several parties in Iraq, Syria, several groups in Lebanon, and the Palestinian rejectionists or resistance movements. And if you take Syria out, that whole equation changes.
I appreciate those overviews. I'm going to quote from a Global Research article that you wrote called From the Cold War to NATO's, in parentheses, Humanitarian Wars, The Complicity of the United Nations. And I'll quote this first two paragraphs. Humanitarian wars, especially under the guise of the responsibility to protect, are a modern form of imperialism. The standard pattern that the United States and its allies use to execute them is one where genocide and ethnic cleansing are voraciously alleged by a coalition of governments and media organizations and non-governmental front organizations. The allegations, often lurid and unfounded, then provide moral and diplomatic cover for a variety of sanctions that undermine and isolate the targeted country in question and thereby pave the way for military intervention. This is the post-Cold War modus operandi of the U.S. and NATO. In facilitating this neo-imperialism, the United Nations has been complicit in the hijacking of its own posts and offices in Washington. Former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan has been appointed a special peace envoy with a meditating role in Syria. Yet, how can Annan be evaluated as an honest broker, considering his past instrumental role in developing the doctrine of R2P, the very pretext that has served to facilitate several U.S.-NATO criminal wars of aggression? Furthermore, the evidence attests that the U.S. and its allies, despite mouthing support for Annan's supposed peace plan, are not interested in a mediated peaceful solution in Syria. Now, that said, here's my hypothesis, and I'd like, if you would please, to see if any of this makes sense, and if it does, to lend your measured and more scholarly insight. I believe that it is inevitable, whether it's in this election cycle or after January, that Iran will be attacked. But if you look at Iran, you're looking at a country that's three times the size of Iraq. You're looking at hundreds of thousands of armed individuals who are fully aware of how to engage in urban and guerrilla warfare. This is not Saddam Hussein's army that could be obliterated in a matter of days. You're also looking at people who have knowledge that this is going to happen and are looking at what they can do to represent some protection to their own country. Right now there's a peace movement, a democratic movement in Iran that had protested and were beaten down by the regime and its president and the mullahs in the last 24 months. I believe that if you invade Iran, you're going to unite a lot of these people, especially those who feel now that it's much of the Western world against Iran, because bombs do not discriminate. Weapons of mass destruction do not discriminate. And when you blow up a nuclear facility, you are releasing the nucleotides and the different radioactive materials, including plutonium, into the atmosphere. You're also using depleted uranium in these massive bombs, which will mean environmental destruction and a higher instance of death and deformities and birth defects, even if you're 100 or 1,000 miles away, which have we proven. I did a documentary on this and have written an article on it, and which we refuse to pay any attention to in Iraq. There's one hospital we filmed for one of my documentaries on Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own, in one of the towns that had been at the heart of a major battle, and the doctors in the hospital have thousands of photographs of babies who are deformed and died of rare cancers they had never experienced in their medical career in the history of the country. And yet no embedded American journalist ever presented the birth defects, the number of children who've died, the number of parents who are afraid to have children because everyone knows what's likely to happen, and yet depleted uranium has a half-life of 3 billion years, and it goes everywhere the wind goes, and it gets into the soil, the water, the food, and people's bodies. And a lot of American vets are coming back with Gulf War Syndrome. 750,000 have filed claims, non-battlefield claims, because of illnesses, and 73,000 to 76,000 have died, according to the Veterans Administration's own statistics. And I just presented a documentary on this on Saturday in Los Angeles before a packed house, a veterans film called American Veterans Betrayed and Forgotten. And I spoke with people clear up the high command. In fact, a woman came over to me afterwards and said that her husband had just retired as a major general in the Army, and she could attest to the veracity of the claims in this film. And now he can do more that he's outside of the chain of command than he could when he was inside, because he's limited. So now we're going to be putting depleted uranium into Iran. We're going to cause massive radiation release, even if it was in a non-radiation construction. There's still radioactive materials that will be released. You're not going to be able to destroy everything that's there, but you will, in likelihood, unite much of the people. So what is the outcome then? Well, then we can say that we supported Israel. How good are we? And that you're not going to take a second look at the 22 member nations, the Arab League, as if they're all going to stand by and support this? I think not. Looking carefully at each one of the 32 Arab League nations and their current policies, at least half are going to side, not necessarily with Iran, but they certainly will side against the United States and Israel. Then you have the situation. Now what do you do? You're not going to leave anything. You're going to have to destroy as many facilities as possible. So it'll cause anywhere from 14 to 2,400 flying sorties to do this. You're going to cause the Iranians to do something. What are they going to do? Well, they can, you know, bomb the Straits of Hormuz. 65% of the world's oil goes through there. And they can attack many of the Saudi oil fields, because they're going to say that the Saudis are co-conspirators in this. But who's likely to align themselves? Well, Russia and China, Brazil and India are in alignment in their trading with Iran. So what is the likelihood that they're going to stay quietly by? All China has to do, and this is my final point, is that we'll never have a war with China. It would be suicidal and stupid, and if we couldn't beat... under 100 al-Qaeda in Afghanistan with 160,000 troops, including mercenaries, and over $1 trillion spent, what is the likelihood that we could defeat the largest army in the world that has sophisticated technologies and fully capable of inflicting nuclear disaster on us as we would them? No one's going to engage in mutual annihilation. But instead, all China has to do is say, okay, we can no longer support you economically, so we're not loaning you any more money. Oh, that's $5 billion a week gone. $5 billion. And also, we are no longer going to support the U.S. currency. Well, if you think that China's sitting there with $1.7 trillion in T-bills, think again. They've been spending that money to build 17 phantom cities in the middle of their nation, housing 65 million units. And they built factories, they have bought farmlands, they've rented farmlands, leased it in Russia and in South America and in Brazil. So they've gotten rid of probably, I'm going to guesstimate, 4/5 of the money they've been holding. So for them to realize that when you drop the dollars, that reserve currency, and go to a mixed currency, which has been advocated now for the last several years, and they're doing exactly that now with Iran and India and Russia and Brazil, then the dollar is going to do what? It's going to drop like a lead balloon. With the dollar dropping, with oil the next day, the day after Iran is bombed, the day after the war starts in Iran, and it will be a protracted conflict, because how are they going to capture in a gigantic country hundreds of thousands of armed individuals who are trained in urban warfare? Well, then the price of oil is going to go from $82 to $92 a barrel to anywhere from $200 to $300 a barrel. I expect $300 based upon speculation, realizing the hedge fund managers, how powerful the need for oil will be, and therefore make enormous profits from it. They did this before without war, when it went from $47 to $147 a barrel. That was all manipulation. So now the average American is going to wake up one day, a week after everyone's heralding the great victory, we took out the nuclear facilities, we've put them, bombed them back to the Stone Age, and they're going to look at a $15 to $20 a gallon of gasoline. And if it's wintertime, fuel oil for their homes. Now the price of an airline ticket will triple. The price of food will double. Hyperinflation. And when the dollar is no longer the reserve currency, now you're going to have both hyperinflation and hyperdeflation simultaneously. Does anyone stop long enough to realize that China and Russia never have to go into a military adventure with the United States or misadventure because of what they could do economically? And then, what will this do to our image in the world, supporting Israel in a preemptive attack against someone that has never invaded anyone and represents no threat to the United States or anyone else? After all, if they got one bomb, which there's no proof that they're creating a bomb, to the contrary, and Israel has at least 160 to 240 nuclear weapons and never signed the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, nor did India, and is non-accountable, what does that do then, and what does that say, that if at any time Israel uses nuclear weapons, then we would have supported weapons of mass destruction, and the only nation in the world to ever use weapons of mass destruction in the form of radiation was the United States in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Does anyone see that there is a disconnect between the reality of our motives and words and the likely outcome? Those are some of my thoughts. I realize they're purely speculative and hypothesis, but I'd like for you to address them if you would, please.
Well, we share a lot. It was very long, but I'd like to start off by addressing the Arab League. Amongst the Arab states, the so-called people, I'm not saying so-called people, the Arab people or so-called Arab street, you are going to see popular support for Iran. Overwhelming support for Iran is going to be for Iran. Some of those governments is very different, and even if they support the United States, some of them will be afraid to say it because they'll be afraid of a revolution in their own country or upheavals, and they're already all in shaky states. But I would not put my faith in the Arab League. They've been working against all their co-Arab countries, starting from the Palestinians to Lebanon to Libya. It was the Arab Street League that rubber stamped what happened in Libya. The United States uses Arabs to wage these wars by rubber stamping them, and the same thing's going on in Syria. You know, they expelled Syria from the Arab League just like they did with Libya. So I do agree about the Arab people, but the governments, they are very these regimes. That's what they are. Most of them are regimes, dictators in the pockets of the United States for one reason or another. Even though they might verbally side with Iran against Israel, of course, but you'll see the action on the ground is different. After all, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, look at their actions in Syria and Libya, and even to an extent against Iran. You know, the appointment of Prince Bandar reflects that the hostilities against Iran are going to increase. And the United States wants this as well, as does Israel. They want hostilities between, stronger entrenched hostilities between these Arab states and Iran. I agree with you about the nuclear fallout, and this is something that the general public is not really aware about, the effects it's going to have on the regional countries and the entire world. You know, we all share this world, and something like this will affect everybody in one way or another. I think that the Russians and the Chinese definitely want to clip the hands of the United States. And I actually, speaking to a colleague of mine about this, I'm very glad you brought it up. The Soviet Union, before it collapsed, was broken financially. It only had its military power left, and that was going away. My colleague, a professor at the University of Ottawa in political science, he said that the United States is very similar now. It's trying to save itself. All it has is its military power. And if a regional war breaks out, because if there is a war with Iran,
the very minimum we can expect is a regional war that from the borders of Greece, just in Southeast Europe, from North Africa, from borders of Egypt, goes all the way to the Chinese border. You'll see a regional war. And World War One and Two both started as regional wars. Now, that could be the worst-case scenario, is a broader war. And the Russians have, if we see this type of support for Syria, I think the support for Iran is going to be far stronger from the Russians, because their security, National Security Council, has said that an attack against Iran is against the national interests of our country, and we can't allow it. Now, the Russians play a very strong diplomatic game. They're far stronger. Hillary Clinton can learn from the Russian foreign minister about diplomacy. They still refer to the United States as their, and Britain and France as their Western partners. The Chinese are very quiet, but to cripple Iran, just like we've mentioned, the road to Tehran goes through Damascus. The road to Moscow and Beijing, which are being encircled, you know, Hillary Clinton called this century the Pacific or Asian century, and we know the United States is moving its fleet around China. You know, it seems that they want to encircle these countries and disable them from being able to react to any attack on Iran. But that's not part of the longer picture, but an attack on Iran will be crippling them. In many ways. First of all, Russia, the encirclement of Russia would almost be complete. They would lose their near abroad. That's the former Soviet republics of the Caucasus and Central Asia, which have very strong historic, cultural, linguistic, and social, as well as economic relations with Iran. You know, Persian is spoken in some of those areas, as well as other languages spoken in Iran, spoken there. Azerbaijan, a lot of those areas actually were at one point the same country with Iran, like Azerbaijan and Armenia. They were Iranian provinces at one point. So there is a strong historical connection. And not only that, trade routes and oil terminal routes. The United States has prevented oil from going through Iran, which would have been the best route for getting oil and gas out of those areas. But once, if Iran falls out of the falls into the American orbit, this would change, and this would be disastrous for the Russians. So this would.
Unfortunately, I am going to have to come. This is Russ Baker again.
Mahdi, we're having a little technical difficulty with your telephone. We'll reconnect with you. Let's go over to Russ Baker. Russ Baker, you've been listening. I'd like a final thought from you to summarize your thought.
Sure. Well, first of all, I mean, it's all fascinating and very, very important. One thing that strikes me that I think needs to be said is that we keep talking about the United States and we keep talking about Israel and so on. Actually, the United States is a country with a lot of competing forces battling it out. I think Israel is also not a monolith. We know that the former leaders of the Mossad and the Shin Bet, the military intelligence, have both publicly made statements against Israel attacking Iran and saying that Iran is not a threat to them. I think it's very important we avoid kind of monolithic categorization of any of these countries. We all have sort of mortal struggles going on inside our countries, and I think it's important to emphasize, and this is one of my big beefs with the conventional media in this country, is that either everything is characterized as United States against other countries or as left against right. I think that's all fairly inaccurate. I think it's the interests of the majority of the people in this country and the world versus a small number of incredibly selfish and greedy and short-sighted people who have disproportionate power. What we can do ourselves and what we're committed to do with whowhatwhy.com is that we want to get out there and report about how it is that in a purported democracy, a very small number of people, whether they're powerful people in the oil industry or they are hedge fund operators, how these people managed to have so much disproportionate power, even with the so-called liberal Democratic President Barack Obama, disproportionate amount of influence with him, with Hillary Clinton, and what have you. That, I think, is something that we also need to focus on, because none of these things are going to be able to be fixed unless we address that.
I appreciate those insights. Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, the website whowhatwhy.com. Thank you very much, Russ Baker. And we've now reconnected with Mahdi. Darius, please continue your thoughts. They dropped out there at the very end.
Well, as I was saying, I don't think that the Chinese and the Russians are going to be passive, because they are the targets of this as well. An attack on Iran in the long term is targeting them as well. You know, one Chinese flag officer, a rear admiral, and this is a person of high military office, said that we wouldn't hesitate to get involved in a world war scenario with the United States, while lecturing at the Chinese National Defense University. We wouldn't hesitate to get into a world war scenario over Iran with the United States. So they have their economic cards. And I want to emphasize that the Russians and the Chinese don't want war. It's very clear that they don't want war. They rather deal with things diplomatically or through economics. I'm not saying that they are enlightened governments, but this is their policy is not one that is primed towards war. They are not militaristic. Like, U.S. foreign policy is militaristic, and it doesn't take a genius to see that. But I think Iran will be a country that will, at the very minimum, be lead to a regional war. But there is the possibility of escalation, which should be considered. It's not something it shouldn't be looked at lightly. They've made it very clear that they're not going to stand for it. Now, we could see some sort of escalation. They would affect the average American more than just economically in regards to what happens in Iran. And I'd like to point out that the Iranians also have made very strong promises on what they would do to U.S. interests internationally. We can see in Syria something that Libya didn't have. Libya didn't have key allies at all. It didn't have allies, and this was one of their downfalls. It made too many deals with different sides. It wasn't entrenched in any alliance system. The Syrians are, and we can see that it's really helped them. It's kept them in. The Iranians are much more entrenched in an alliance system than the Syrians are. And they have allies in Latin America, and I don't know what they'll do aside from diplomatic and economic measures, but you will see global ramifications for a war in Iran, which you know, world leaders have warned against. World leaders have warned against. Even President Bush himself said, Bush Jr. said that a World War III could arise in Iran when Vladimir Putin went to Tehran, and President Bush rushed to the White House podium and said World War III could break up, could start, ignite from Iran. Now, since we're talking about this, I want to point out that I don't think Israel should be looked at as the culprit in an attack on Iran, because the Israelis can't launch an attack on Iran without the United States. As much as the media is parroting this, and as much as Israeli security, intelligence, and military officials are against it, in fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu today, Benjamin Netanyahu said he'll accept sole responsibility. But there has been an American-Israeli study group, a political-military group that constantly discusses this. The subject is constantly discussed. And there would have to, the United States would have to have some knowledge. It would have to give some sort of green light. I know that Netanyahu and Obama have some differences because of their political alliances with Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud, with the neocons, and there is that internal geopolitical divide that's got two camps in both countries working against each other. But on this subject, they have discussions. And without a U.S. green light or some sort of U.S. consent, and obviously there will be U.S. support. Once the war breaks out, the United States is not going to stand there. It will be involved. Either it'll be involved from the beginning or it'll get involved later.
I agree. I just think that as many times we hear the best and brightest meeting, look how many times they have been wrong. Look at how many misadventures we've had. We had the best and brightest, did we not, in the Vietnam War? And look at the outcome of that. And look at the legacy that's left. So everywhere that we go, we end up making a gigantic mess. And for Israel to be posturing, even though Netanyahu has 80% control of the Knesset now, where his Likud party at one time was very small, now it is not. We have to understand that in two separate efforts to overtake Lebanon, they failed miserably. And they were not able to get more than 29 miles into the country with Hezbollah and fighting them off, and with just the weakest of weapons in guerrilla warfare. So you're talking about they've never been able to go in and conquer and hold, though they were there for over 20 years. But look at what you're dealing with in Iran. You're dealing with a gigantic country that has been armed by Russia and China and using their intelligence networks. It would just be stupid on every level for a conflict to occur. But I believe the only reason that you're seeing this conflict in Syria escalating is because it is the next step before Iran. And anyone who thinks that all this is happening and all this social dissent, even the legitimate dissent by the pro-democracy movements in Syria, which have a legitimate grievance and should be voicing themselves, you wouldn't be seeing everyone ratchet up the talk. And you wouldn't see the CIA in there, and you wouldn't see Al-Qaeda in there that has been had various factions within the CIA supporting different factions of Al-Qaeda. It's not one group. If it weren't because this is a prelude. I just see all this leading inevitably to a war with Iran, whether it's, and I believe, and this may sound extremely cynical, but I believe that after we saw the Federal Reserve get $16.3 trillion in secret payments and 22,000 transactions to hedge funds, Verizon, McDonald's, banks, international banks, $2.3 trillion to Citibank, $2.1 trillion to Bank of America, with no collateral except junk. And it was only Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul who had, through the law that they passed, to allow us to even know that these transactions occurred. Not a penny went to the American public. Not a penny went to small business. Not a penny went to help people in home foreclosure. That I trust no one in Washington. I believe no one. Anyone in Washington opened their mouth, I know that they're going to tell me something that supports their position, irrespective of whether it supports the truth. So are we capable of this misadventure? You bet. Look at Iraq. Look at Afghanistan. Look at Vietnam. Will we try to cover ourselves? You bet. And whether it's, and I absolutely agree with you, Mahdi, that we would never allow Israel on its own unilaterally, and they would not try it, but with our full support or using NATO, which is our full support, one way or the other is going to happen. Will Barack Obama do it? I believe that we may end up with an October surprise if they see that Romney makes a surge. If not, I believe it won't happen before the election. If Romney gets elected, it is absolutely set in stone he's going to do this. He is one of the most... I can't believe how stupid this man is. Anyhow, those are my final thoughts on it.
I wanted to add something to that. The war with Iran has... It's been some years that a dimension of it has started. There's been a... You know, Iran's never had... attacks on its borders until the United States occupied Iraq. There's a heavy intelligence war against Iran, and the killing of nuclear scientists is part of this war. Cyber attacks are part of this war. So to a degree, it started. Now, a full-out conventional war, this is something that we have to wait and see how it plays out. But
we should be clear that the war, at least a few dimensions of it or elements of it, have already begun. And the war in Syria is a front in the war against Iran.
Would you agree also that unreported in the American media is the number of intellects and scholars in Syria who have been assassinated?
Yes, this, I definitely agree with you.
That would not be insurgents doing that. That would be black ops. That would be in the Mossad and national intelligence.
Oh, definitely, because the Israelis hunt. They have specially trained hunter teams. It's come out that they've been doing this in Iraq. After the occupation in Iraq came, they immediately targeted intellectuals and professionals. This is the Israelis. This is a policy they have: is to prevent technological and scientific development in states they see as enemies, and they've been using Iraqi Kurdistan, that's northern Iraq, or which is run by the Kurdistan Regional Government, to do this. It's been referred to as an Israeli base, that area, and they've been hunting down intellectuals in those countries. The Mossad is involved in Syria. There's no question about it. Like I said, even the Washington Post admitted this. By saying they were on the border with Syria, they sent weapons into Syria. In fact, leaders of the Syrian Syrian Free Army, or their spiritual leaders, have been interviewed on Israeli television, where they've been saying, and I'm referring back again to that Orientalist rhetoric about Shiites versus Sunnis, which is wishful thinking that the U.S. and Israel want. It's the Israelis that have this mindset of Shiites versus Sunnis. Anyways, they've even brought up the fact that, oh, Sunnis have nothing against Israel, we have to fight the Shiites. Anybody from the Middle East that hears that most people, normal people, with elementary knowledge of the area, would dismiss that and say, "There's no way that you'd find people talking in those terms." You know, this is a new phenomenon that's been emerging there, and it's actually a colonial phenomenon that's been projected into that region, where people are talking in terms of Shiites and Sunnis. Because in fact, Shiites and Sunnis have very little differences. I can count the differences on my two hands. You know, they use the same text. Their prayers are essentially the same. They are the same, except for one sentence, some Shiites say. And the only difference between them was a political difference of who should have been in charge of the Muslims. That's basically the difference between Shiites and Sunnis. It's not even as great as the difference between an Orthodox Christian or a Catholic or a Protestant. But yet you see this fighting, and this fighting has been projected from the outside. And regimes like the Saudi regime have an interest, and you were absolutely right to mention that there's a foreign hand in that wants these upheavals. Because, you know, the United States has done nothing about Bahrain. It's done nothing about Saudi Arabia. It sent weapons, in fact, to these places. But in Syria, you see them capitalizing on the situation and fueling it. You know, there is legitimate grievances against the Syrian government. But, you know, a lot of the people who had those grievances have been killed, too, and it wasn't by the Syrian army. Leaders of the legitimate domestic opposition in Syria have been killed by the same Syrian Free Army that's fighting against the government. The same anti-government forces, which include foreigners in their ranks, are even killing the legitimate opposition in that country. In fact, most people don't know that there's a domestic opposition in Syria that's been there for years, and many of them have been to jail, and they've seen hardship, and they're against foreign intervention, and they've said the Syrian National Council and the Syrian Free Army do not represent the Syrian people. In fact, most of the people in the Syrian National Council are hand-picked people who've lived abroad. They haven't lived in Syria. They don't know about what's going on there. People like Radwan Zaida, who speaks a lot on CNN and BBC, this man, if you look at his history, first of all, he's involved with the same people that created the Transitional Council in Libya. He's gotten awards by the National Endowment for Democracy, and he's been given a blank check, an open platform in a lot of media circuits, from Al Arabiya to Al Jazeera to BBC Arabic, to talk about what he wants. You know, and they're not critical of Israel. When they've been asked about Israel, they basically brush it aside, say nothing.
But they do say something about Iran. Well, we have to cut our ties with Iran. We won't have the military relationship we have. We'll cut our ties with the Palestinians and with Hezbollah in Lebanon. This is the stuff they'll say. But in Israel, quiet. It's very clear that they're talking to Western capitals, to Tel Aviv, when they have interviews. Wall Street Journal, in fact, one of the first interviews, the first leader of the Syrian National Council, Professor Qailyoun, one of the first interviews he gave was to the Wall Street Journal, and it was about foreign policy. And what was the foreign policy? It was something that people in Tel Aviv and Washington would love. We'll cut our ties with Iran. But when it comes to other things, they say nothing. They say absolutely nothing about Israel. In fact, when the leader of the Shiites in eastern Saudi Arabia, the Ayatollah there, who's been equally as critical of the Syrian government as he has been of the governments in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, was arrested. This so-called Syrian opposition stayed quiet. Even though this man was against the Syrian government, just like them, they stayed quiet. And that really shows where their political colors are. Even when they speak about the king of Saudi Arabia, they've called him a Democrat. Can you believe that this Syrian opposition refers to the king of Saudi Arabia as a true Democrat? We shouldn't be blinded by the faults of the Syrian government to thinking that this is some sort of democracy movement. You know, people should ask where their weapons are coming from, where their funding's coming from. Well, we know where their funding's coming from because the people funding them, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, have admitted it, and they. Before they even publicly admitted it, everybody knew where it was coming from. Before everybody, the British and the U.S. governments admitted they were going to support them, we knew they were supporting them. You know, and now there's reports that Turkish and Saudi officers have been caught in Syria. I'm still waiting for them to be validated, but American, Russian, and Iranian, as well as Turkish news wires are reporting that there's been officers captured there. So I'm waiting to see if that's going to be validated and authenticated. But we should not be fall into a trap of thinking this is some sort of spontaneous democratic movement. Because first of all, the members of the Syrian opposition. Legitimate oppositions were targeted by these very same people. These people are killing people on the basis of their sectarian background. They want a sectarian war. This is the U.S. wants another Lebanese civil war in Syria. In fact, if this government in Syria collapses, you won't see a government in Syria. You're going to see 100 different little fiefdoms, and there's going to be fighting
just
there
like
for a
Libya.
Long time. Like Libya, and that's what Israel would love. You're going to see it spread into Iraq. The whole idea is to have a sectarian civil war. You know what these people, their chants are in Syria? Their chants are Alawites to the ground. That means death. That means the Alawites should die. And Christians to Lebanon means all the Christians should leave Syria. This is why all the patriarchs of the Christian community in the Middle East are very concerned. Even the Vatican has made statements about this. The Vatican's press is reporting about this. The head of the Syriac Orthodox Church, the head of the Greek Orthodox Church in Syria, the head of the Melkite Church in Syria, all of them have spoken out against this. The head of the Maronites Church, which is based in Lebanon, but he's the head for everybody in Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, he's spoken out about this. All these church leaders have spoken out and condemned this fighting. And one of them, a cardinal, an archbishop of the Roman Catholic Church and the patriarch of the Melkite Church, he has said that this is not a pro-democracy movement. They're killing and targeting people. That what the media is saying is lies. But you don't hear that in mainstream media. If he said something bad about the president of Syria, you'd hear it all over CNN. But when he condemns these thugs for killing people, you don't hear a word about it. The head of the Druze community has condemned this. Even the Grand Mufti of Syria, which represents the Sunnis, the majority Sunnis, has said this. But you don't hear these things. They're just pushed aside, and instead you hear what some anonymous groups based in Britain are saying, or they take YouTube pictures and doctored evidence and talking to pseudo-activists whose funding we should ask where it comes from. CNN had a gentleman by the name of Danny who was in Syria, and then they caught him on tapes doctoring the videos, and then CNN had to bring him back again, and they made him say, "Have you been paid by CNN?" And he said no, because they wanted a record. It was so embarrassing to them, and this is the type of activities they're conducting. But I want to go back to that point that the road to Tehran might be from Damascus, but remember, Tehran's not the end of the trip. The road to from Tehran is going to Moscow and Beijing, and the Moscow is after Tehran. And these are very strong nations, and the consequences of these actions, we don't know where they'll lead. The United States wants a contained regional war in the Middle East that'll disrupt that area and disrupt its oil shipments and hurt the Chinese economically. That's what they want. But we don't know how it's going to play out. The Iranians have a lot of military capabilities, and they have allies. They're not alone. So this could go well beyond the borders of that region.
I appreciate you sharing your insights and your scholarship with us on our program today. My guest, Mahdi Darius Nazimzadeh, a scholar, sociologist, geopolitical analyst specializing on Middle East and Central Asia, research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal, and a contributor at the Strategic Cultural Foundation in Moscow and Voltaire Net, and a member of the Scientific Committee on Geopolitica in Italy, the author of Globalization of NATO, and website globalresearch.com and voltairenet.org. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Gary Nall. We still have one guest to go, multi-award-winning journalist, investigative reporter Finian Cunningham, who's also written for the Irish Times, The Mirror, The Independent, and from Belfast, Ireland. He's now in East Africa, and we're going to go to him in a moment, but first, a brief break and back with Finian Cunningham.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a
hey,
big party, man.
Yeah,
I
brother,
can
like,
dig it.
Stop it. Right on.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Hey, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and you're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our final guest today is Finian Cunningham. He's written extensively on international affairs, with articles published in several languages, and many of his recent articles appear on the renowned Canadian-based news website Global Research. He is a master's graduate in agricultural chemistry and a worker as a scientific editor for the Royal Society of Chemistry, Cambridge, England, before pursuing a career in journalism. He specializes in Middle East and East Africa issues. His focus includes the nature of imperialism and war, socialism, justice, peace, and trade policies, ecological impact, and human rights. Finian was based in Bahrain and witnessed the political upheavals in the Persian Gulf during 2011, as well as the subsequent Saudi-led brutal crackdown against the pro-democracy protest. For many years, he worked as an editor and writer in the mainstream media, including The Mirror, Irish Times, The Independent. Originally from Belfast, Ireland, he is now based in East Africa, and he is there studying the issue and continuing his investigation. So it's always nice to speak with someone who has firsthand experience being in the war zones or zones of conflict, who can give us that particularly overview that we're not getting from others. Nice to have you with us today, Finian.
It's a pleasure, Gary, and thank you for having me on, and hopefully we'll enlighten your listeners. So thank you.
Good. Now, this program is unique in one sense that I really encourage my guests to lay out their entire arguments for us without me interrupting them. I'll just give you a few overviews to begin, and then you take it from there and take any part of my overview that you choose and address it, all right?
Sure, sure, Greg.
Okay, and we are speaking with him from Africa, so it's you're listening on Skype. Now, here are my concerns, Finian. I'm concerned that we're repeating what we did in Libya. And look at Libya today. It is completely fractured with over 900 different tribes all vying for power and the oil and water resources. And we have more Al-Qaeda and terrorist activity in Libya today than at any time, and certainly more than under any of the previous Gaddafi regime or before or after. We also see that what we did in Iraq by saying we're bringing democracy, peace, and freedom, that I don't see how it's possible to do that by interfering in people's civil conflicts, and especially when it's now known, as it was in Libya, that we have had boots on the ground. We've had our intelligence agencies actively supporting the insurgents, and yet we have not defined who these insurgents are. Are these truly pro-democracy native Syrians who feel that the Assad regime was brutal and repressive and unfair? Or are these also outsiders, provocateurs, who are mercenaries and doing the business of other multinationals or corporate interest of some type or governmental interest to reshape the landscape? And what role has Israel played in this, since by taking out Syria, then that makes Iran more vulnerable? So I'm concerned that the American media, including, and ironically enough, the left, have been pro-invasion or pro-supporting of what they're calling the insurgents without having the scholarship or knowledge from people on the ground, or choosing not to look at the truth. And I'm not here to support one side or the other. I'm merely here to say, what are the actual facts? Those are my concerns. The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, wow, you've covered so many aspects of all this. It's a pleasure to talk to somebody who's so well informed and so concerned about the diversity of aspects that you've outlined there. Where to begin? Yes, I mean, I think that your concerns are very real, very valid, that Washington and its Western allies in London, Paris, and Berlin, well...
We have a
agenda towards Syria and the Middle East in general. I mean, let's put this in historical context. Washington and the Western powers were very happy with brutal dictators for decades. Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, Ben Ali in Tunisia, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, right across the Arab world, and it still goes on today with the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. The Western powers rely on strong-armed dictatorships to enforce their economic policies and their hegemony in the region. So the notion that the Western powers have got any interest in democratic reform or human rights is a complete myth. It's a cynical myth. So when the upheavals began in the Arab world, the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, with the poor guy who set himself on fire in Tunisia at the end of 2010, that then set off a whole chain reaction of protests in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, where I was based, Jordan, all those Arab countries, as a measure of how disillusioned and how frustrated those people, the mass of ordinary people, were with their dictators, their Western-backed dictators. The people got out on the streets and they wanted, big change, like democratic change. They wanted to have, elected governments, all these virtues that Western governments profess to support and, embody. Well, the people in those countries got out en masse, protested for those kind of like basic human rights. And the Western response or the reaction to the upheavals, well, I think that really illustrates their cynicism and their deception. You know, first of all, they backed to the hilt the likes of Hosni Mubarak and Ben Ali until it became apparent that it was untenable. So the face of the dictatorships in Tunisia and Egypt had to go, kind of thing, because it was no longer tenable or plausible to keep supporting these guys. But I mean, if you look at the what's succeeded, the figures of Ben Ali and Mubarak, you know, still the Western-backed regimes are still in power. The military is very much in power. They might have had elections, and the guy in Egypt, Morsi, was elected a Muslim Brotherhood candidate. But I mean, you know, the military have that country very much under control, and it's an American Western-backed military to the tune of something like $2 billion every year, and has been for the last 40 years. So the regime, the Western regime, is very much in place in the likes of Egypt. With a little bit of a facelift or window dressing in the form of an election. But the structure of power is very much the Western-backed regime. Now, the proof of the, if you like, the cynicism of the Western government, Gary, I was just getting interference from another call. The proof of the Western cynicism and, how would you say, complete disingenuousness towards the Arab Spring is, you look at somewhere like Saudi Arabia. You know, look at Saudi Arabia, look at Bahrain. The Western governments, Washington, London, Paris, Berlin, have absolutely no interest in supporting the people in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, who are out on the street now every day, have been for the past year, but they are out on the street every day, and they're being shot on the street by the state forces. They're being imprisoned by the hundreds and thousands. They are being denied, being thrown out of workplaces. There's been complete travesty of prosecutions in martial courts, military courts, with doctors and nurses in Bahrain. Now, what is the Western government saying about those scenarios, those situations? Absolutely nothing. Nothing. Now, and you know, if you focus on that, we focus on the case of Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, that proves, to me, that proves that the Western governments have absolutely no interest in democratic principles or genuine democratic reform, because when the chips are down and the people in those countries are protesting for those very basic rights. You know, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, William Hague, David Cameron, have given so little support for those people materially. I mean, there might be a little bit of lip service now and again, you know, to say that we support democratic movements and what have you. But the bottom line is that these regimes, the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia, the Al Khalifa regime in Bahrain, are consistently and continually backed by Washington and London. Now, in the case of Syria, I hope I'm not
no, continue.
Going on too discursively, no. And I hope I'm kind of cohering this argument to your reader, listener's satisfaction. But now, when you look at Syria and Libya, what I think is the evidence shows there is there's a cynical involvement of the West in Syria and Libya. Now, those two Arab countries, they felt the reverberations of the Arab Spring, sure. I mean, I'm not saying that, for example, Gaddafi or Bashar al-Assad in Syria are by any means, you know, paragons of democratic virtue. I mean, there's problems in those countries to do with democratic representation and all the democratic rights that we assume that we have in the West. So when the Arab Spring took off in early 2011, yes, I mean there was reverberations in those countries people got out on the street because it was a region-wide wave of popular protest and expression of dissatisfaction with the status quo. But I think the evidence, and we can go into this further in the conversation here, but the evidence would prove that the Western governments have very much hijacked the popular grievances in Syria and Libya to infiltrate those countries with their proxies and mercenaries from all around the region, the sort of a jihadi kind of militant, you know, Islamic extremists that the West has cultivated for decades out of Afghanistan along with Saudi Arabia. And they've infiltrated Syria and Libya with those kind of elements to unseat the government of Syria and Libya. They've succeeded in Libya and they're trying to do so in Syria. Now, why they would do that? Because, well, Libya and Syria had a certain independence from the Western governments and the Western hegemony in the Arab world. For all their faults, the one thing that you could positively say about the Libyan and Syrian governments is that they were independent from the Western financial system, the Western political policy in the Middle East, which is very much supporting Israel, which is a completely illegal and criminal state in its treatment of the Palestinian people for decades. Syria and Libya were quite outspoken and critical of Western policies across the Arab world. So the West has had a long desire to get rid of the Libyan government and the Syrian government, and they certainly want to get rid of the Iranian government, although it's not an Arab country, but it's likewise, compared with the other two that I've mentioned there, Iran has got an independent foreign policy in the region. So Iran, along with Syria and Libya, is very much in the sights of the Western governments to get rid of what they call regime change, because it's a thorn in the backside for Washington and London, for their desires to have hegemony in the Arab world. So any kind of obstruction or thorn in the side for the Western governments in the region, i.e., you know, Syria, Libya, Iran, must be got rid of, must be changed. And this is where, when we look at the Arab Spring, the Washington and its Western allies have very much, in a very cynical, deceptive, disingenuous way, has utilized the reverberations that, you know, happened in Syria with regard to popular demand for reforms. They completely hijacked that, and they've completely distorted what started out in Syria to blown it into a covert operation to unseat the government in Syria, as he did with Libya.
Okay.
Let me just stop there, Gary, and hopefully you know, I covered the question coherently as you were requiring.
Finian, you did, and I appreciate the overview. And please, for the audience, some of the technical glitches are because we're talking with him from Skype in Africa, and every time he gets an incoming call, it blanks out the voice. Now, my second part, which is my concluding part, I would like for you to focus on the following, if you would. It is my impression that the major conflict will not be between Iran and Israel, or Iran, Israel and the United States, or Israel, the UN, and or NATO, all of which is the United States. But it's going to be when China, that supports Iran, Russia, that supports Iran, India, that supports Iran, and Brazil, that supports Iran, and will continue to, when China has the capacity to simply say, we're not going to take any more of your debt, and we're going to use mixed currencies, that, for all intents and purposes, when the dollar is no longer the reserve currency, could have devastating, would have devastating impact upon all financial markets in the world, but mainly the United States or countries holding dollars. You'd have see a flood of people getting rid of dollars, and I happen to believe that China has been quietly using our T-bills, our treasury notes, to build phantom cities of 65 million living spaces, to buy giant tracts of land in Africa, to lease land in Russia and in South America, to build factories. In fact, they've been using the $1.72 trillion that they have given us over the last 10 years when they've been in a 10.2 to 11.1% growth per year. They've used that. They're not holding all that money. Americans may be naive enough to think, oh, they wouldn't possibly do anything that would jeopardize them losing the value on their own investment. Not true. Everyone knows no one's going to be able to redeem the U.S. T-bills. They're giving money to the United States like Saudi Arabia and other countries because they want a favored position in our power structure. So I see that as a consequence of Syria goes, civil war in Syria, the breaking up the country in at least seven different factions that all are vying for control, we supporting two of those factions, massive sectarian violence and ethnic cleansing, much like we saw with the Shia decimating the Sunni in Iraq, and we took credit for stopping that. We didn't take credit. They simply had killed enough of each other that there were no longer mixed neighborhoods. And then we armed the Sunnis with 100,000 of the Sunni awakenings getting $400 a month. So now that they were armed, they weren't killing Americans. And I see this happening all over again, as if we didn't learn a lesson from Iraq or Afghanistan. And then I see an attack on Iran, which I believe is inevitable. If Obama feels he's not going to win the election, I see that there is a possibility of there being a preemptive strike sometime in October. If he does, it could be any time or not at all, but definitely Romney would do an attack. So one way or the other, there's about a 75% chance there's going to be an attack upon Iran. If that happens, the price of oil will go from about $88 to $92 a barrel to about $200 to $300 a barrel overnight, with the bombing of the Straits of Hormuz, which the Iranians are going to do. The Iranians have got over a half a million highly armed, very well-trained urban fighters. They know they are going to be attacked, and I believe that they're going to go after Saudi Arabia, because remember, 84% of all of the Islamic community are Sunni. Only a relatively small percentage are Shia. And Iran is Shia, Iraq is Shia, But Saudi Arabia has a large Shia community that it discriminates against. They treat it brutally, and they give all their support to their Sunnis and the Wahhabism in there. So now I see the following. Mm-hmm. I see the Arab League, 22 nations of the Arab League, I see it substantially siding with Iran. Only about four countries I see not. I see that where there's a pro-democracy movement in Iran, you bomb Iran and you start killing all the different civilians, I see Iran actually unifying in an effort, something that no one could have done before. We would have caused that to happen. And then I see the price of oil in the United States going up, gasoline going up possibly to $15 to $20 a gallon. Imagine the price of food. Imagine the price of an airline ticket. Imagine the price to heat your home. We're already struggling. I would see that this would cause us to have the greatest depression, the worst depression, the most suffering in our history in the United States, all within 12 months of this happening, and all because we are playing reckless with neocon philosophy of act, then think, do not consider the unintended consequences of your actions. That's what I see happening, and I believe that Syria is a part of this. I blame the UN, which is now pro-war. I blame NATO, I blame the United States, and I blame Israel. Your thoughts?
Well, Gary, you've outlined a very, very real, very accurate, grim picture of the precipice that we are collectively at in the history of our world. I mean, and very sadly, tragically, it's we've been here before in previous conflagrations in history, just over the last 100 years. I mean, there's something I have to say that there is something in the DNA of the capitalist system, you know, rivalries between nations over resources for elite advantage and elite power competition. This leads to conflict and it leads to war. This has happened so many times before. We can go back to the First World War, the Second World War. We haven't got time to go into those major incidents in detail. But you know, if your readers or your listeners look into it, they will find that it was national rivalry over capitalist interest and imperatives that led to those conflagrations, and we're here again. Now, I think, you know, China and the US, there is something very pertinent about those two countries in particular. I mean, here you've got the United States, which is an economic power that's really on the wane through its hollowing out of its manufacturing and the good productive base that was at one stage symbolic of American democracy, or you know, relative good economic prosperity. That whole foundation of the American society and economic system is gone. It's massively indebted. By contrast, you've got China on the rise, which is going to compete for resources, in particular, oil and gas, also influence in huge part of our world, Africa. China is very well received here because the countries of Africa see it as not like the old European Anglo-Saxon kind of predatory kind of capitalist exploitation. People in Africa, whether you agree with it or not, but from my experience, people across Africa see China as a mutual partner that's interested in partnership in developing African infrastructure and social economic development. And of course, it's not all charity. I mean, China is going to reap the benefits of that, but they're going about it in a much more, mutual approach that African people respect. Now, America and the Western European powers, I can imagine they're absolutely green with envy over China's inroads into such a huge part of our world with huge untapped resources that Africa represents. And in particular, let's look at Libya. I mean, China had billions of dollars co-invested in Libya in the oil and gas sector, which it lost overnight when NATO embarked on its criminal bombing of Libya under the guise of protecting human rights. I mean, this is, they brought in the no-fly zone, which quickly transformed into a massive bombing campaign across Libya that carried on for 7 months, something like over 11,000 bombing sorties that probably resulted in 50,000 lives being lost under the guise of protecting human lives. Well, that criminal project disinvested for China billions of dollars overnight, and the Chinese, I just can't see how they're going to stomach or go along with the repetition of that kind of criminal enterprise that's currently being sought after in Syria. And I mean, it's not going to tolerate that another comparable loss of billions of dollars of money. China is allied with Syria and as Russia is. So, but as you said or alluded to in your very eloquent introduction to this particular part of the program, Gary, it is all about the bigger picture of China and Russia being perceived, probably quite rightly being perceived by Washington and its Western allies as being an economic threat. Now, I mean, that while you can say that it's perceived as an economic threat, I mean, that in no way morally justifies going to a military agenda towards China. But this is what the capitalist system involves. It involves that kind of where a competitor country like China to America is seen as a threat, therefore it legitimizes militarist agenda, therefore it legitimizes a war, through proxy engagement in China's allies like Libya and Syria. Now, I mean, before we get carried away with that, I mean, that's morally and legally unacceptable. I mean, just because a country is seen as a threat doesn't justify in any way the militarist agenda, but that's the nature of the capitalist system, the global capitalist system. And, if we recognize that, then that begs the question, well, we have got to change the system. And that's what millions of people around the world are trying to do, because the system has completely expired in its usefulness. For a while, for decades, it was a very productive, very beneficial system in terms of delivering social progress. But the system has completely expired. It's now turning into a cannibalistic kind of system where it's cannibalizing American society, European society, as it always did with the poorer countries around the world in Asia and Africa. But it's becoming a global cannibalistic system that needs to be completely challenged and overthrown. And for one, apart from the social, nefarious consequences of the system in America, but on the basis of, on one item alone, on the safety of the world, to prevent wars, the massive wars that are looming through the capitalist system, principally between America and China, that's in itself is enough reason to change the system, to challenge it, to overthrow it. But there are many other good reasons for overthrowing this system that's completely outlived its usefulness in terms of
historical. Fenny and I have just one final question for you. And if we can make this relatively short, and to your comments, for the average person, they would find it difficult to believe that we would go through this massive armament program, this pathetic excuse of threatening China, which is not possible, with putting some bases and soldiers in a ring around them, the same with Russia. Russia and China together, we could never win a war against either country. All we would do is self-annihilation, and I don't believe we're going to do that. It's all posturing. But they had the economic advantage. The next war will be an economic war. It won't be a physical war. But I think Freud tells us something that lets us instinctively understand our destructive power of urges. He warned in his book, Civilization and Its Discontents, that if we could not regulate, or if we could not understand, or if we could not restrain our negative and destructive impulses and urges, that we would end up, as many of the classicalists throughout history, the great philosophers, suggested, we would end up, as you said, cannibalizing ourselves in a vast conflagration. Now, he said, and I think it's appropriate that we understand the significance of this, that our objective today is not to love one another, one nation to a nation, or respect one nation to a nation, or to fairly exchange goods and services one nation to a nation without exploiting the labor of another or the resource of another to this disadvantage. And hence even our own brothers and sisters. Rather, Freud said it was to satisfy our aggressiveness on our fellow human beings, to exploit his capacity for work without compensation, to use him sexually without his consent, to seize his possessions, to humiliate him, to cause him pain, to torture and to kill him. Now, we've seen that in Bosnia. We saw it in Iraq. We've seen it in Afghanistan. We saw it in with the Serbian militias. We saw the rape camps and the torture centers. We have seen this repeatedly. And it was also Freud who says man's natural aggressive instinct, the hostility of each against all and of all against each, opposes this program of civilization. So the question is, for you, when you look at what is the possible outcome of invasion of Syria or the continued ability to bring in mercenaries, even Al-Qaeda, the most radical of the Islamists, who are many of these fighters, to fake incidents, even though there are crimes of humanity on both sides. But then we have to ask, to what end? What do you see that end as being? The likely scenario. Final thoughts from you.
Gary, I mean, again, very eloquently posed the question. Without repeating what I said previously, but I mean, I think the system, the capitalist system that has prevailed for the last, say, you know, 400 or 500 years, I think it's not in a senescent form or even a cancerous form. It's completely destructive and cannibalizing not only countries abroad but our own countries at home. Which, you know, for decades there was a delusion that, you know, America, Europe was relatively prosperous. The human cost, the human and ecological costs of the capitalist system were they were hidden in far off, you know, distant parts of the world, Africa and Asia. But I think, you know, the system is now becoming manifestly cannibalistic and destructive right in our own societies. And this system has been the root of wars over the, you know, ever since it's you know, ever since it came into existence. It's naturally, inherently programmed for rivalry, conflict, not only within society but between societies. And you can look into the roots of the First World War, the Second World War, the Vietnam War, so many interventions, imperialistic interventions down through the last 100 years alone, and they all crisp back to the imperatives of control of resources, profit for corporations, who have politicians around their little finger, and the Pentagon and what have you. So I think to address your question succinctly, Garrett, I mean, I think what's happening in the Syria and the Middle East is very much like the all these conflicts are crystallizing right now in the Middle East. They have been there with Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya. It's, you know, latently with Iran, but they're very much crystallized now in Syria. And the allies of Syria, Russia and China are, you know, could be dragged into this conflagration that the West is programmed to pursue, because, you know, it's all about the control of resources and primarily oil. It's unavoidable in the capitalist system. In its dynamic, in its imperatives, you cannot. It's like trying to negotiate or to reason with a psychopath. When you cannot do that, when the system is programmed to pursue those kind of interests, the interests of controlling resources and primarily oil, which the whole capitalist system is based on. So I'm afraid to say that we are talking about a collision course here, that unless people in America and Europe and around the world actually challenge, stand up to and overthrow, not only because of it's the right thing to do with regard to war and world peace, but it's to do with our own societies, preserving our own societies, the way our societies have collapsed massively over the last few years under the capitalist system. We have to challenge that system to resurrect our societies, to renovate our societies, and also to prevent the war the system is hell bent on creating in the Middle East.
Okay. Finian, you've done a very good job of showing us a different perspective, and I appreciate that. And all the best to you in keeping up the good work at Global Research, and we appreciate the good articles done by that website. Finian Cunningham, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's a pleasure.
And again, I apologize because of the Skype, but I believe we were able to hear most of what he had to say. I'm Gary Nall, and this concludes another one of our Progressive Commentary Hours. Thank you all very much for listening.